A Playlist Original.
Welcome to the Pilot Podcast,
where we review the pilot episodes of TV shows to answer your question, should I watch this?
My name is BJ.
And my name is Me Too.
And this week, we're watching The Peripheral on Prime Video, Easy Bake Battle on Netflix, From Scratch on Netflix, and I Love You, You Hate Me on Peacock.
So stay tuned to the end to find out what BJ's signature dish is.
Ooh. Okay, I'll think about it throughout the episode.
I gave you some homework. Good. Before that, tell us what happened on The Peripheral on Prime Video.
Sure. Based on the 2014 book of the same name, written by William Gibson, The Peripheral is set in a future where technology has altered the society, and an ambitious woman named Flynn, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, finds herself doomed at the hands of fate. While trying to hold together the pieces of her broken family, she discovers a secret connection to an alternate reality and her own dark future. And joining her on this adventure is Wolf Netherton, played by Gary Carr, Burton Fisher, her brother, played by Jack Rayner, Connor Pinsky, played by Eli Garee, and Aelita West, played by Charlotte Riley. So, Me Too, what were your first thoughts about The Peripheral?
My first thoughts started before I even hit play, which is, it is 73 minutes. It is a 73-minute pilot. At this point, we are about 15 to 20 minutes short of a solid 90-minute film.
That is true. This is a very long pilot episode. I feel like they are trying to be faithful to the book, which I didn't read, but that extended runtime could be giving them the leeway to fit in everything.
Which is difficult to balance. The idea of adapting from a book that obviously has such a fandom that Amazon optioned it for a show. So you want to do right by the people who love the book, not leave anything out. But then for the rest of us who are unfamiliar with the story, I think there were some places where they could have trimmed. I thought the story itself was really interesting. The video gameplay, the action scenes, all of that was fabulous. I think some of the background setting, they should have tightened a bit. There were several scenes reminding us that she is growing up in poverty and her family has health issues in Appalachia and difficulty accessing medicine. I could have used like 40% fewer scenes of that and I would have understood it the same.
That's fair. We did learn a lot about her life rather slowly.
Yes.
But outside of that, we saw some cool world building. What did you think of the future of 2099, and then the slight future in 2032.
It was fascinating. Her brother is a veteran. It looks like there is some kind of technology implanted inside of his body. And then as a function of maybe being a veteran or some of his expertise, he is someone who tests video games. And she helps him do that because as a woman, she's not taken seriously as a video game tester. And when they put on the virtual reality headsets or what they perceive to be virtual reality, the gameplay on the other side of it is really cool. Though I am curious about the rules because she is her brother on the other side of it. So everything her brother does she feel it as herself or as her brother?
That is a good question, which they haven't explored yet. I assumed that she is feeling it as her brother because that's the body in the simulation that is feeling things. But maybe the technology can transition it to an equivalent so she feels it as her body would feel it.
Okay, that makes one of the hookup scenes really weird, like even weirder. Yeah, where she hooks up with someone in the game as her brother. Sort of unsettling because one of the first things she says when she comes out of the simulation was like, it all felt so real. And you're like, okay.
And she has a little daydream where she drifts back thinking about that makeout session and it's like, which one of you liked it?
Gross. And then her own world is very dark and scary too, with lots of potential action, especially now that some stakes have been established for the safety of herself and her family.
Yes, we see that there is a mysterious Colombian company with a lot of funds that they're willing to give out. We see some new people coming into town. The local drug dealers are also going to be an issue. There are threats all around Flynn.
Everywhere. All she wants to do is go to work, pine over her ex, take care of her mama, and get the medicine that her mom and brother need to manage their pain. And instead, she is fighting at every turn.
And in the simulation, because she can feel everything, she has to go through a very gruesome ordeal. So content warning, if you don't like people touching eyeballs, there will be a moment when you will want to stop watching for a minute or two.
Y'all, it's gross. For my fellow babies, very strong warning. It is disgusting.
But outside of that, she's being sent on all of these missions. But are the stakes high enough for you? I know she's doing it for the money, but that's really it right now.
Yes. At the very end, we start getting a little bit more information on the potential of this alternate reality future simulation world. And we start to understand some of the stakes. But broadly, there's just mention throughout the episode of like, the world's fate is in your hands. But there is no clarity around that. We don't see any despair, death, destruction. So we don't know what could possibly be coming yet. We don't have a hint of it. Just at the very end, there's a little bit of action that lets you know something is to come. Just not that much.
Is that hint of what's to come enough to keep you watching The Peripheral on Prime Video?
I would say for my fellow non-sci-fi people, I don't think this is the one that will bring us into sci-fi. I don't think, to your last question, Beach, which was very leading, the stakes were high enough for me to put aside the fact that this isn't really a genre that I enjoy for me to keep watching more.
That's fair. I think it was enough for me. I would keep watching casually. I do like the technology that we're seeing in 2032 and in 2099. And I also like the brother-sister dynamic, not the body-swapping sharing part, but their relationship in the real world.
The literal Freaky Friday.
So I'll keep checking it out to see what Flynn gets wrapped up in.
Let's take things from alternative reality to what felt like one with Easy Bake Battle on Netflix. This show, hosted by Anthony Perowski, features talented home chefs who use full-size Easy Bake ovens, aka ovens, to make two rounds of meals with the goal of winning $25,000 in this episode and a later $100,000 grand prize. In this first episode, contestants must make great late-night snacks and then use pantry and frozen items to make another great meal. So, Beach, how did you feel about this one? What's the criteria we're working with to achieve success?
Now you're giving the leading questions. It is very unclear if this competition is about the food, as in the recipes and the presentation of the final dish, or if the judges care more about the chef and their personality and their backstory. This is a reality competition, and usually a good sob story can get you far, and I think that might be the case in Easy Bake Battle.
Yes, I don't think anyone watching will be surprised by who won this episode. Not a knock to any of the home chef's talents, but I think everyone will watch the three intro videos and know immediately who will walk away with the $25,000 in this first episode.
Did you like the home cook storyline that they're pushing, that these are just regular people cooking every day at home, and now they're competing with those same everyday recipes?
I love it. I love reality cooking shows that feature home cooks. I love when you can see that someone who is not trained in a formal school or even went through the restaurant system could still be very talented at what they do. They can find a lot of passion in it. I think we have seen this with social media, especially over the last 10 years. It's really blown up, the idea of these home cooks building huge followings and developing their skills for all of us to enjoy what they've learned. I would say in this one, I just didn't get the criteria between presenting a great tasting dish and having the easiest possible dish to recreate.
It was confusing and a little deceptive because I feel like the judges kept putting in new rules or hints for what they were looking for throughout the episode. Like, make a great meal. Make a great meal really quickly. Oh, and also make a great meal really quickly with the fewest ingredients.
And the least time.
And none of that was said at the very start, which makes it a little hard to understand how are they going to judge these dishes.
I agree. I was confused by what helps you get a leg up. How did you feel about the challenges themselves? The late night munchies, cheesy, crunchy, fried snack, and then the more formal meal for the second round.
I liked it. I think that helps emphasize the home cook part of the show, where what would you eat when you and your friends get home late on like a Saturday night? And what would you do if you only had frozen food to cook with? And I think that's where you might get some cool recipes to share with the audience if you tailor these challenges to real world scenarios.
That's a good point. I could make everything I saw. Whether I want to leaves some questions in the air, but I could make everything I saw. Not that I'm this like super talented cook.
Are you going to make some wontons tonight?
No, I'm not. I don't think that's for me. A Philly cheesesteak wonton, and I can't remember the other one. I think I'm good off those. That does raise the question for me that you brought up before we started recording. How do you hack cooking? That's one of the central themes of this show.
Yes, every shortcut, every easy dish with only a few ingredients, Anthony would say that's a hack. But you're still cooking, so you're not really hacking anything. And I feel like it's rude to call some of these things shortcuts. Using frozen vegetables isn't a shortcut. It's just cooking with vegetables. So the language threw me off.
I agree. They treated it like it was Leonardo da Vinci inventing like all of these different things when they were like, you used ranch powder instead of making ranch from scratch. You used a pan to boil pasta. It was stuff that I think maybe 10 years ago would have felt fresh, but in the world of BuzzFeed videos, even prior to that, with like Homemade with Sandra Lee on Food Network or Rachel Ray, I feel like we've gotten a full range of what they're considering hacks, which are otherwise just ways that families can make meals faster. And to your point, some of it felt rude in the sense of a lot of people grow up with frozen vegetables or canned foods or things like that that are made into wonderful meals. And it feels strange to treat that as this like magical, shocking thing when that's how so many people eat.
Exactly. They're bringing in what they are presenting as just your average home cook, and then they're treating it as this spectacle that everything they're doing is this mind-blowing thing that a trained chef would never think to do.
So with that, do you want more trained chef mind-blowing meals through Easy Bake Battle on Netflix?
I think I would watch this while I'm cooking.
Mm.
Only because in the preview for future episodes, someone is doing a hack with a pick comb, and I just want to find out how and why that is brought into the kitchen.
Okay, I didn't think I wanted to watch more episodes. I was just going to recommend like Nailed It or Great British Baking Show as alternative lovely shows of varying levels of skill of home cooks. I also am very curious about this comb to cook. And so my rating is, BJ, please tell me the episode that this comes up so I can see what someone does with an afro pick, you said?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Very interested in seeing that.
Well, how about we go from a show all about hacking cooking to a show with a fully trained chef from scratch on Netflix? This show was inspired by Timby Locke's memoir of the same name, and it stars an artist who finds romance with a chef in Italy. We have Zoe Saldana as Amy, who's embarking on a life-changing journey of love, loss, resilience, and hope across cultures and continents. She's also joined by Eugenio Mastrandrea as Lino, Ruby Hammer as Sloane, Danielle Deadweiler as Zora, and Keith David as Herschel. So, Mitu, what were your first impressions of this romance story with lots of food?
The most important thing in any romance, the chemistry, off the charts, between Amy and her sister Zora. I completely bought that relationship. Between Amy and Herschel as her dad, completely bought that relationship. And then between Amy and Lino, sizzling. It was so good. As I was watching, I was thinking, these two people just need to be in more things together. It is as though they were made to be on screen together.
Yes, there's definitely those couples where you see them together and it clicks, like, yeah, that's you're in love.
It's you got just that how spark.
It's got to be. It's meant to be. And Amy and Lino have that. Kudos to the actors for oozing that romantic energy. It feels so natural, and there's that will they, won't they, as this first episode goes along. But, you know, it just has to happen.
I will say that maybe it's because it is based on a memoir that is such a sweeping love story. To your point, Lino was almost too sweet, too earnest. There wasn't really anything bad about him. It was about Amy getting it together to try to be in a place where she feels comfortable dating him in this first episode. He was just there waiting for her. Delicious meals on deck, sparkling personality on deck, very good looks on deck. He had nothing he needed to work on.
Exactly. Once he changed his shoes, he was good to go.
That's true. She critiqued his shoes. That's it.
And then, like you said, Amy has all of these other barriers. Does she want to be with Lino? Does she want to be with Giancarlo? Does she want to go back to law school? Does she want to listen to her mother? Does she want to listen to her father? And Lino is too sweet. And then he's like, I'll wait here, smiling and ready. Just figure it out. I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going to date anyone else. And I will also cook you dinner.
He was Elliot Yameen saying, baby, I will wait for you. That's all it was. It was just so precious. But for me, I don't mind the sickly sweet of that because I love a very earnest love story.
Yeah, there's some escapism to this show where we're just diving in deep to romance.
And Florence.
Yes, we're in Italy and we see so much food, which stood out to me because Amy is an artist there to train and hone her skills, but we don't see very much art.
Even her own. We don't see too much of her own skill. We see a few drawings here and there, but not enough that we're like, this is her style, or this is her thing, or this is where she hopes to go. They were like, let's focus on the love story. Even though they had a full hour, this was an hour-long pilot, 50-something minutes to tell this story.
And she meets a man who either works or owns an art gallery, and she only walks through there briefly.
Yeah, they were like, let's make the camera really fast, let's go back to the chemistry, let's go back to the love, don't focus on anything else.
Yeah, remember that restaurant? Let's go back.
Which does make me think of the story itself. This isn't a spoiler. This is in the premise of the show. This is the basis of the memoir. We know that, tragically, Amy will lose Lino. Lino will have health battles, and he will pass away eventually in the show. It is a story of grief as much as it is about love. So I think, to your point, you spun the positive on this, that like their chemistry is so great that you care so deeply. But I couldn't help but feel a little bit of sadness as I watched, because I knew that on the other side of this epic love story, just as epic grief coming.
Yeah, that is sad. And that's tough. But maybe you can enjoy the journey to that point, enjoy the buildup of their love before they have to transition. Well, Amy has to transition to the next phase.
So do you want to watch more episodes of From Scratch on Netflix?
I think I would watch it while doing laundry, just have it in the background, see some more great Italian food. How do you feel?
For my fellow criers who love a good romance story to just sob and sob as you watch, this one is for us, but you have to be in the mood. So after I watched this first episode, I knew I was not in the space. I didn't want to like spend my afternoon crying, but like a cozy weekend coming up this fall when I have a couple hours, watch it like a movie, and I'll get to really, to your point, get caught up in the love story and then have a good, healthy cry at the end of it. And I feel like a lot of people enjoy watching that way, too.
Wow. What a weekend.
A good planned cry. You've never done that?
No, I can't say I have.
Oh, we live different lives.
That's true. We're different people. So how about we go from a show that'll make you cry to a show about hating?
The Hateration. Ooh, you're talking about I Love You, You Hate Me on Peacock. Using exclusive interviews and archival footage, this docuseries explores the spectacular and oddly violent response to Barney the Dinosaur and his rise to popularity. In this first episode, we learn about Barney's roots, shifts in American society and television culture, and how Barney's creator, Cheryl Leach, and her family will never be the same.
Ooh, mystery. So me too. How did you feel learning about the history of Barney? How and why the show was created?
It was fascinating. So the origin story is that there weren't television programs catering to very young kids. Cheryl Leach found this major gap in the market of shows that could hold the attention of her then toddler. And it is so interesting to me how people don't take young people's interests seriously or even hold curiosity about exploring them, especially back then. There's so much more content now that appeals to young people. So that was fascinating to me that there could be a gap that huge, especially in public television. And then it was fascinating to me that there was no marketing budget behind Barney. So it was this grassroots movement of moms calling each other. That is so interesting.
I agree. I was fascinated about how Cheryl brought this all together and it all kind of aligned with the people who are on board. And it makes a lot of sense. So to our listeners, I'm not a parent, so I don't know too much about how to entertain two-year-olds. But I do remember my mom telling me that I loved watching Disney movies on repeat. And then hearing Cheryl say that her son at this age really liked repetition, hearing the same songs over and over, it now makes sense why a show like Barney would be appealing to this age group. So I felt like I learned something.
When I was like 4 or 5 years old, I watched Cool Runnings every single day.
Yeah, little kids don't get bored watching the same thing.
I watched it last year and I was like, this holds up. This is good. The taste I had as a youth.
Maybe even adult me too doesn't get bored watching the same thing.
I can really watch the same stuff very often. What I will say is that while you and I are very different people who don't plan weekend cries, we do have very similar moms who are not absolute haters. The hateration in this show was stunning to me. I think we were children during this, so maybe you had a little bit of exposure to people kind of teasing kids who still liked Barney. I never saw this as a kid. At least I don't remember it, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no sense of this huge backlash against Barney. They show that they made fun of him on TV shows, other children's shows, on SNL, on like adult programs, which is very, very weird and gross, that jealous dads who saw that Barney had captured the attention of their kids would string him up and cut him up and held conventions to tear him apart. They had an I Hate Barney Secret Society newsletter. It was shocking to me. And then I didn't realize that there was homophobia against Barney and jokes about HIV/AIDS. I mean, the weirdos came out.
Very odd. Like you said, had hints that there was people who disliked Barney. I remember in elementary school, once we kind of aged out of watching a lot of PBS content, kids would pick on other kids who still liked Barney. And I maybe remember like a joke on Robot Chicken or maybe even a joke on Simpsons, but I didn't know how strong the hate was. And it's probably because in the 90s, at peak Barney, I was still a kid, so I didn't see all of this.
It's wild. I was stunned by it. And I think that is where the documentary gets you. you think it will be salacious. I think in the trailers, the documentary seems to almost be positioned as like juicy. But instead, for me, I felt overwhelmingly sad. It was sad to see adults hate that they didn't like the show that is capturing the hearts of their children and teaching their children kindness. I hated to see the misogyny, the homophobia, the hatred against people with HIV or AIDS. It was just so uncomfortable and concerning. And it made me feel really sad about, not to get serious about it, but the roots of that culture and the backlash we've seen even this year with like people being mad at Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings and Disney, Ariel, all of this stuff of any sort of displays of queer people, black people. It just made me sad. I was like, damn, this is just horrible culture.
Yes, it's very horrible. It's sad, especially when you hear Cheryl repeating that she made this for toddlers. It is for toddlers, for her son specifically, and that all these people take it so personally. They take a giant purple dinosaur who is your imaginary friend in the world of dinosaurs. He's actually a little stuffed animal that these kids are pretending to play with. And that incites anger in adults who are not the target of the show and whose own children enjoy the show seems so odd.
It seems very grounded to me that especially back then, and we still see that now in larger discussions, people just hate kids having agency. The idea of babies independently liking something that is super appropriate and made for them, but because it's not additionally made for their parents, the idea of them having interest and agency outside of their parents is too much.
It's like adults hating on Baby Shark.
Yeah, though I bet that song got to be a lot.
That's probably how they feel about the I Love You song.
No, my mom and I loved it. She loves it.
An N of two. There we go, folks.
But on the positive side, it was lovely to see how kids reacted to it in the rise of popularity side. The fact that they were selling out arenas, parents had safe places for their kids to go and have fun and take in this really lovely, kind show. And then it was lovely to see the kids' reactions who were on the show. There's an especially touching story. One of the people who was a child on the show, she said that she got to be on the show as someone from the Philippines, and she never got to express her Asian heritage in so many acting gigs. She said she hasn't experienced that much since, and she got emotional talking about the gravity of that for her, getting to be herself and express herself in that way, in that space. That was lovely. And a lot of the other kids spoke to that too, about the diversity of young people presented, but not in a way that was like, here's our black one, here's our this one, here's our that one. It's like a celebration of each child present.
Yes. Shout out to Barney for that. And really shout out to PBS. You see that on Sesame Street and all of their programming, just highlighting that there are different people in the world and that everyone deserves love.
Yes, like Arthur.
But then I guess once these kids become adults, they sometimes forget. And before we get into our ratings, I do want to give a hint of what comes in the next part, because we do hear throughout this first episode in this documentary, people hinting at some darkness. They hint at the challenges that Cheryl faces with her family as Barney becomes more time-consuming of a production and really media empire for her to run. And also, she is considered the mother of Barney, so her son, Patrick, who the show is created for, supposedly felt jealous of his imaginary purple dinosaur sibling.
And her husband felt jealous of her success.
So there's a lot going on there that I am pretty sure is explored in the next episode.
Yeah, I think that's a safe prediction to make. So do you want to stick around for more episodes of I Love You, You Hate Me on Peacock to check that out?
I do. I would watch again casually. I didn't think there was that much behind Barney to learn, but I was wrong. We glossed over a lot in this first episode, including the person inside the Barney suit. There's stories behind both of the people who did that role. So yeah, I'm going to keep watching. How do you feel?
I agree. I think it is fascinating. And the only thing stopping me from saying would watch again seriously or recommending that people watch again seriously, especially docuseries Hive, is the fact that it is so dark. I don't think I would have felt good if I watched more episodes, no matter how curious I was. I think this is one that I'll want to space out over a few weeks to just catch each episode of this series separately. I don't know that I would marathon it, and I don't know that I would recommend that, because it does just get so dark. It's very sad. It's very interesting, but very sad.
True. Content warning.
Yeah. Content warning. You'll just feel like, ugh, after.
This is the bad cry, not the good cry.
True.
So my signature dish, are you still curious?
Of course.
I'm going with chocolate chip toffee cookies.
Oh yeah, those are so good. Y'all, maybe email BJ at askthepilotpodcast@gmail.com and maybe he'll send you some. They're delicious. Delicious. I've even brought them to work events to impress people with BJ's baking, not my own.
I forgot about that. You got your own personal decorator helping you out.
You even packaged them for me. So I looked like I put in all this care and you did it.
Oh, that's the kind of friend I am. And if you want to see and hear more about our friendship, check out more episodes of The Pilot Podcast at thepilotpodcast.com. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast platform.
You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at ThePilotPod. And you can send thoughts, feelings, show recommendations, because every other week we do a show recommended by you, our wonderful listeners, to askthepilotpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Bye.